Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, ConocoPhillips CEO, Shale Will Come Back, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. ConocoPhillips is considering increasing its oil and gas production as economies around the world are reopening and prices appear to have rebounded. The Houston oil major, which in May and June shut down a third of its production, about 400,000 barrels of oil per day, said energy companies are starting to think about lifting self-imposed production caps as crude prices have climbed back to near $40 a barrel. West Texas Intermediate crude, the U.S. benchmark, was trading Tuesday morning around $38 per barrel. We're thinking of slowly coming back into the market over the next few months and reducing the amount we've got curtailed because we're seeing some strengthening in the price, CEO Ryan Lantz said in an interview published Tuesday by energy research firm IHS Market. ConocoPhillips joined several energy companies looking to restart wells and increase production as coronavirus-related restrictions ease around the globe. Concho Energy and Parsley Energy are reopening existing wells, while EOG Resources said it plans to increase production capacity in the third quarter. Lantz, in a wide-ranging interview with IHS Market Vice Chairman Daniel Yergin, said he's worried that oil prices could take a double dip if OPEC and Russia decide to suspend agreements on production cuts that have been extended through July. In addition, Lantz said oilfield service companies, which ConocoPhillips contracts to drill wells and extract oil, will take time to recover from the latest oil bust, having laid off thousands of workers. Lantz, however, said he is not worried about bringing wells back into operation despite some industry concern that wells could be damaged if they are closed or shut in for several months or longer. Pressure is equilibrating around the wellbore, so when you open it back up, you do see flush production come back, Lantz said. It takes time to produce all those deferred barrels, but presumably you're producing them in a much higher commodity price environment. The energy industry, Lantz said, had never before experienced a sudden drop in demand for petroleum products such as gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. The subsequent oil crash has forced energy companies, including ConocoPhillips, to shut in thousands of wells and raise questions about the future of shale drilling, which propelled the U.S. into the world's top oil producer and ushered in a decade of growth in Houston. Lantz said he still believes in the viability of shale oil production, but acknowledged energy companies must focus more on delivering a higher return on investment for shareholders, many of whom had soured on the energy sector. Shale's not broke. Shale's not gone. Shale will come back, Lantz said. But I do think it comes back slower, because there's going to be pressure on companies to confine their capital program and maybe not grow as dramatically as before, because I don't think the access to capital and investor community is going to be as robust as it was over the past decade. Oil and gas producers must live within their means and offer more dividend and shareholder-friendly decisions to woo investors back into the energy sector, Lantz said. The CEO acknowledged that Wall Street has lost money investing in energy over the past decade, and that energy companies will have to focus less on growth and more on returning capital to shareholders. ConocoPhillips lost $1.7 billion in the first quarter, compared with a $1.8 billion profit during the same period a year ago. Revenue fell by more than half to $4.8 billion from $10 billion in the first quarter of 2019. Ultimately, Lantz said, it's difficult to say whether U.S. oil production will recover to the record levels seen before the coronavirus-driven oil crash. U.S. crude production hit a record 13 million barrels per day in February before the virus wiped away 2 million barrels a day of production. It would be pretty difficult for us to return to 13 million barrels a day, Lance said. We'll get back above 10 million, above 11 million, maybe encroaching on 12 million. But a lot of that depends on the shape of the recovery. This article is entitled MISD Board to Hear Calendar Survey Results by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD Board may not wait for all parents and teachers to respond to a survey on next year's school calendar before making a decision on which one to use. Officials said Tuesday that the district may elect to make a decision about the calendar today during a special virtual meeting to be held at 4:30 p.m. The district still encourages parents to complete their survey to make their voices heard, according to an email from MISD Executive Director of Communications, Ilana Ladd. The district had stated earlier that responses to surveys of parents and teachers wouldn't be collected until the middle of the month. Even in its second survey delivered to parents and teachers, it states that the survey didn't have to be turned in until June 12th. Wednesday's special board meeting is for the purpose of presentation and discussion, Ladd wrote. After receiving feedback from parents and teachers, it was apparent that some people were interested in an intersessional calendar, but did not favor the format which was presented. In response to this, a second intersessional calendar, which incorporated this feedback, was developed and shared with parents and teachers via a second survey. The second survey also asked additional questions about virtual learning and provided more opportunities for open-ended feedback. Ladd also reported that in both surveys, the percentages of respondents for or against a particular choice has held steady as the total number of respondents increased. As of Tuesday, 6,529 parents and 782 teachers took the first survey, and 3,640 parents and 742 teachers have taken the second survey. She also wrote that the data, as it exists from both surveys, will be presented to the school board on Wednesday, and that should results of the second survey look different on Friday when the survey closes, that data would also be shared with the board. It is possible that trustees may elect to make a decision about the calendar on Wednesday, Ladd wrote. Midland ISD board members already approved a 2020-21 calendar that calls for the school to start on August 19th and end on May 28th. There are 11 holidays, or students' days off, on that calendar, not including a full week for Thanksgiving, 2 weeks for Christmas, and a week for spring break. The already approved calendar has 172 instructional days. During the May board meeting, MISD and staff approached district leaders again about the intersessional calendar, which is being used in some districts around the state. Midland ISD leaders patterned their first calendar on the one used in Socorro ISD, which is in the El Paso area. The second intersessional option calls for school to start on August 17th instead of August 3rd, as in the first intersessional option. The last day of school is still during the last week of June. There are four fewer holidays or student days off compared to the first intersessional option. However, there are still the two full week periods, one in October and one in March, that can be used to provide additional academic support. This article is entitled Proposed County Budget Would Cut Total by 43% by Caitlin Randall. Midland County's first proposed budget for the 2021 fiscal year would be 43% lower than last year's budget, according to a copy obtained by the Reporter-Telegram. Some departments could be facing harsher cuts than others, including community services, which could see its funds slashed by 93% if the budget is approved. Midland County's total proposed budget for the next fiscal year is $149 million, 43% lower than the 2020 adopted budget of $239 million. The proposal is based on the requested expenditures of each department head. Department heads were asked to lower their budgets by 15% because of expected revenue loss from the coronavirus pandemic and oil industry downturn. Rather than across-the-board 15% cuts, the proposed budget shows several departments are requesting the same or nearly the same in funding, while others are facing substantial cuts. Community services budget could be cut by 93%, from $5.1 million to $363,000, according to the proposal. If approved, it would be the lowest amount of funding for that department in at least 5 years, and significantly lower than 2019, when it was allotted $14.6 million. The major differences between Community Services' 2020 and 2021 budgets appear to be in funding for the City of Midland. The city received about $2 million this year, and it will be allotted no money next year if the budget is approved. The purchasing department's proposed budget is 75% less than the allotted 2020 budget, down to $432,000 from $1.7 million. This is largely because they have not requested funding for any vehicles next year, which accounted for $1.3 million of this year's budget. Information technology could also see cuts in their allotted funding. The budget proposal shows that the department is requesting $5.1 million for the next fiscal year, down 65% from this year when it was approved for $14.5 million. Those proposed cuts are largely in equipment, equipment maintenance, and software maintenance. The Horseshoe Complex has requested 73% less in funding for the next year, $648,000 compared to $2.4 million this fiscal year. The difference can be mostly attributed to an entry called Professional Services. While they requested $1.2 million for professional services in 2020, they've requested no funding for professional services for the 2021 fiscal year. Other departments' requested budgets are nearly the same as this year's, including the Sheriff's Office, which will have lowered its budget by 1.6% if approved. The Sheriff's Office proposed budget makes up 16% of the county's total proposed budget of $24.4 million. The Emergency Management Department is requesting 34% more in funding than they received last year, according to the budget documents. Part of the increase is a request for $130,000 to purchase two Zumro outdoor shelters. Pictures of those shelters on the company's website show they resemble the shelters set up outside hospitals in coronavirus hotspots, though the budget does not specify what they would be used for. The Commissioner's Court on Monday began discussing next year's budget. The last budget hearing will be 8:30 a.m. Wednesday at the Midland County Courthouse. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, June 10, 2020. Burt Cornelius Jr. Burt Cornelius Jr. was a man of the greatest generation, born on June 2, 1925 in Bronte, Texas, to the late Burt and Molly Cornelius. He is survived by his wife of 73 years, Oweta Cornelius, his son Gordon Cornelius, and wife Donna of Midland, daughter Debbie Glenman of Midland, son Bruce Cornelius, and wife Carolyn of Lipan. Burt is also survived by 7 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be Wednesday, June 10th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. The service will be June 11th at 1 p.m. in the chapel at Ellis Funeral Home, followed by burial at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, please give to Cal Farley Boys Ranch or your favorite charity. Donald William Gunn. On June 5, 2020, our families bid farewell to a true gentleman, Donald William Gunn, was a man of his word, a man of few words, and a man who always find the right words. Don was born November 29, 1936 in Springfield, Massachusetts, to William and Doris Gunn. Don married his high school sweetheart, Dolores Ann, in 1961. 3 sons blessed their 50-year union, Jim, Scott, and Todd, each of whom Don adored. His beloved wife Dolores passed away on January 2011 after a lengthy illness, with Don always by her side. In 2012, Don met his second life partner, Hetty Tetzlaff. Together they created a life of second chances, exploring the world and sharing many happy times together. Don is survived by his loving and devoted partner, Hetty Tetzloff, his three sons, James, Scott, and Todd, his granddaughter, Heidi, great-grandson, Colin, his Aunt Phyllis and Hetty's children, their spouses and grandchildren. His friends, family, neighbors, and the circle of eight will miss him very much. Services will be held Tuesday, June 9th at 10 a.m. at Rosewood Funeral Home in Humble, Texas, with graveside burial to follow. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the SPCA or the Salvation Army. Patsy Jean Dillard, our sister, aunt, cousin, friend, reached the sunset of her life on May 31, 2020. Born Patsy Jean Dillard, March 6, 1945, to Herbert Henry Dillard and Bessie Lauren Griffith of Midland, Texas. Patsy was preceded in death by her parents and her beloved sister Linda Sue Gallion. She is survived by her sister Shirley Cook, one nephew David Cook and wife Stephanie, one great-nephew Seth Cook and Timothy Gallion, husband of the late Linda Sue Gallion, who is considered our brother and friend. Also by many loved cousins and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 West Mockingbird Lane, Odessa, Texas, 79763. A visitation, musical in nature, will be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 12th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, 3800 North Big Spring Street, Midland. Services will be held on Saturday, June 13th, 11 a.m. at the Downtown Church of Christ, North A and Tennessee, Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood was born March 9, 1922 in Willow Glen, Muhlenberg County, Kentucky. Her parents were the late John Riddle Perry and Willie Tooley. She married Alton Alexander Galt on August 17, 1943 in Brownsville, Kentucky. He preceded her in death and she later remarried. Her last husband was Rayford Wood, who also preceded her in death. Sarah Ruth passed away at Ashton Medical Lodge in Midland, Texas on June 6, 2020. The funeral service will be at Ellis Funeral Home at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 12th. Visitation will be Thursday, June 11th from 5 to 8 p.m. Guests are required to wear masks and social distance. The service will be conducted by Chaplain Clark Rocca of Midland Odessa Hospice. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood is survived by her younger sister, Lucy Helen Perry Cooper of Waynesville, North Carolina. Mrs. Wood is also survived by two daughters, Emma Ruth Stock and Ronnie Lou Davis, and husband Gary. Her middle child, Willie T. Galt Wood, preceded her in death in 2015. Mrs. Wood is also survived by her son-in-law, Thomas Wood, and Snoopy Dog, who held a special spot in her heart. Mrs. Wood has multiple grandchildren and great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, the family wishes you to consider making a memorial donation to Midland Odessa Hospice, 619 North Grant Avenue, Suite 120, Odessa, Texas, 79761. A visitation will be held Thursday, June 11th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, and the funeral service will be held Friday, June 12th, at 10 a.m. at Ellis Funeral Home Chapel, with graveside to follow at Fairview Cemetery. Timothy Joseph Haynes. With deepest sorrow, we announce the passing of our son, Timothy Joseph Hayes. Timothy was born in Midland on April 14, 1988, and passed away on April 16, 2020. At the time of Timothy's death, he was working as a cook and living in Cedar Park, Texas. Timothy attended Lee High School. Timothy was a gifted guitar player. Timothy had the kind of personality where he never met a stranger. He could be in a room 10 minutes and be friends with everyone. Timothy is survived by his parents, Jackie and Pat Hayes, brothers Joshua, wife Heather, Corey, wife Ariel, and nieces Sophia and Desi Ray, and nephew Lincoln, several aunts and uncles and cousins and a lot of friends. He is now in heaven with paternal grandmother Betty Walls and maternal grandparents B.B. and Earlene Watson and Uncle Tom Watson. There will be memorial service at a later date. Tommy Joe Mays. Tommy Joe Mays, 82, went to be with his Savior on Sunday, June 7, 2020, surrounded by his loving family at his home in Baird, Texas. Services will be held on Thursday, June 11th at 2 p.m. in Morrison Funeral Home Chapel in Graham. Burial will follow at Murray Cemetery in Young County. Arrangements are under the direction of Morrison Funeral Home. Tommy was born on December 21, 1937, in Graham, to the late Joseph William Mays and Lassie Faye Moreland Mays. He married Carolyn K. Bond in Midland on July 25, 1959. Tommy is survived by his wife, Carolyn Mays of Baird, sons Darren Mays and wife Kimberly of Baird, and Steve Mays and wife Laura of Flint, sister Mary Glenn Tatch of Midland, three grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. Memorials may be made to Kinder Hearts Hospice, 842 North Mockingbird Lane, Abilene, Texas, 79603. Visitation will be Wednesday at Morrison Funeral Home Chapel in Graham from 6 to 8 p.m. This article is entitled Ector County Reports 8 New Cases by J.C. Lewis. Ector County reported 8 more cases of coronavirus on Tuesday, making the total 214 since the start of the pandemic. Ector County reported 19 probable cases at this time, according to the ECHD website. ECHD also reported that 146 people have recovered. There have been 2,946 tests taken, with 2,659 negative results and 73 pending results. ECHD has contacted 2,043 people during contact tracing. This article is entitled Study, Odessa Arts Boosts Economic Activity by J.C. Lewis. Odessa Arts has given Odessa a boost in economic activity and supports many annual jobs, according to a study done by Americans for the Arts. The nonprofit arts and culture industry generated $6.063 million in annual economic inactivity in Odessa while supporting 200 full-time equivalent jobs. It also generates $600,000 in local and state government revenues, according to the Arts and Education Prosperity 5 National Economic Impact Study. The most comprehensive economic impact study of the nonprofit arts and culture industry ever conducted in the United States. Arts and Economic Prosperity 5 was conducted by Americans for the Arts, the nation's leading nonprofit organization for advancing the arts and arts education. Results show that nonprofit arts and culture organizations spend $3.786 million during the fiscal year 2019. This spending is far-reaching. Organizations pay employees, purchase supplies, contract for services, and acquire assets within their community. Those dollars, in turn, generated $2.939 million in household income for local residents and $362,000 in local and state government revenues. In addition to spending by organizations, the nonprofit arts and culture industry leverages $1.680 million in event-related spending by its audiences. As a result of attending a cultural event, attendees often eat dinner at local restaurants, pay for parking, buy gifts and souvenirs, and pay a babysitter. Attendees from out of town often stay overnight in a local hotel. This page is Local and Oil. This article is entitled Odessa School Board Member Offers Apology for Social Media Posts by Stuart Doreen. Embattled Odessa School Board Member Doyle Woodall claimed Tuesday that he was truly sorry for my offensive Facebook posts and he is committed to earning back the trust of the people. Woodall was scrutinized, including by Ector County Independent School District leaders this past weekend, for Facebook posts that school district leaders claimed were offensive and demeaning. ECISD Board President Donna Smith and Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray co-wrote a letter stating Woodall's posts do not represent the views of Ector County ISD and that they cut across many of those diverse groups. We cannot tolerate this kind of insensitivity. Woodall's comments on social media, according to an article in the Odessa American newspaper, included, "If we want to make America great again, we will have to make evil people fear punishment again." The comments appear with an image of a hangman's noose, according to the newspaper. "It's not murder, and Jews aren't actually people," with a picture of Nazi officers. Spill a few gallons of bacon grease on that street and it would clear out fast, followed by three American flags with a picture of large groups of Muslims in prayer. A comment below, according to the newspaper, also says, "This is not Saudi Arabia. This is Sweet Home Birmingham, Alabama. Nervous yet?" On Tuesday, Woodall wrote, "I have blinders. There are things I don't see and understand because of my culture and personal experiences. For years, I have prayed daily for God to remove my blinders." Woodall referenced being interviewed by a Jewish reporter and then talking with a former deputy commissioner of the Texas Education Agency, an African-American, and that their perspectives helped blinders come off. "Because of these experiences, I am a better man today than I was at this time last week," Woodall said. "Today, I understand why my posts were offensive. I will remove them from my page. I have a lot to learn about cultural differences, and I will dedicate a great deal of time learning by attending cultural awareness and sensitivity training. I want to say again, I am truly sorry." The following is a letter sent out Tuesday by Ector County ISD board member Doyle Woodall. "I am truly sorry for the offense, for my offensive Facebook posts. I am committed to earning back your trust. I have blinders. There are things I don't see and understand because of my culture and personal experiences. For years, I have prayed daily to God to remove my blinders. Last Friday, I was being interviewed by Ruth Campbell, a reporter from the Odessa American, and I was still angry at what I saw as a small group of people trying to interfere with my constitutional right to free speech. Near the end of our interview, Ruth asked me if I knew she is Jewish, and I said no. She told me what one of my posts meant to her as a Jewish woman, and I felt I had been kicked in the stomach. It was the opposite of my intent for the post. I had seen it only from my perspective. A blinder came off. On Saturday, I visited with A.J. Crable, the former Deputy Commissioner for Education in the state of Texas. We have known each other for a couple of years. We have worked side by side for multiple hours on several occasions. I have a lot of respect and admiration for Mr. Crable. He is a black man, and I asked him what that post meant to him, and when he told me what it meant as a black man, again, it was like another kick in the stomach. Another blinder came off. Because of these experiences, I am a better man today than I was at this time last week. Today, I understand why my posts were offensive. I will remove them from my page. I have a lot to learn about cultural differences, and I will dedicate a great deal of time learning by attending cultural awareness and sensitivity training. I want to say again, I am truly sorry. Signed, Doyle Woodall." This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, "U.S. Economy Will Need Stimulus Well Beyond July," by Peter R. Orsag from Bloomberg. In the days before GPS was commercially available, I decided to hike Mount Jackson in New Hampshire. The guide's book said Tisdale Spring was close to the summit, so when I passed a small spring after a couple of hours, I thought the hard part was almost over. After a while of heightened expectation, however, I passed another spring, and that process repeated itself several times before I reached the real Tisdale Spring and thereafter the summit. The U.S. Employment Report released Friday, initially heralded as the end of the COVID-19 challenge, seems much more likely to be the economic equivalent of that first misleading spring on Mount Jackson. Yes, it was good news that the number employed rose by 2.5 million in May, after a decline of 22 million from January to April, But three factors suggest the economy remains fragile and in need of further government stimulus. The job gains were concentrated in just eight sectors: restaurants, dentists, clothing stores, general merchandise stores, specialty contractors, auto dealers, personal and laundry services, and repair and maintenance services. In the other 85% of the economy, employment did not rise. The job gains appear to largely reflect similar reopening rather than any significant underlying economic strength. Whether these and other sectors add new jobs will depend on consumer demand, which will return to full strength only when the public health crisis subsides. Much of the federal government's massive support for the economy will soon expire. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that more than three-quarters of the fiscal impact of the CARES Act will occur before September. It would be foolish to celebrate positive jobs numbers without recognizing how much the colossal stimulus measures have blunted the effects of the economic crisis. It is likewise important to be cautious about what can happen if fiscal support is withdrawn. As I have warned before, without continued support, the U.S. risks a wave of cascading bankruptcies. The first test will come at the end of July, when expanded unemployment benefits, now supporting many families, are scheduled to expire. These benefits should be lowered so they don't discourage people from returning to work, but they should without question be extended. The first two points interact with each other and lead to a third. Beware of zombie firms. If job gains largely reflect a one-time reopening effect and occur only in the context of temporary fiscal support, then it's crucial that we not make the wound look better, but address the underlying infection. Propping up communities and jobs that have no viable future quickly becomes unsustainable. A key question is, how much might the pandemic cause lasting changes in the economy? If there are permanent shifts, as some academic studies suggest there will be, then any future government fiscal support will need to take this into account, so it can focus less on preserving the past and more on investing in the future. There are plenty of opportunities to do so, from stockpiling key goods to hardening infrastructure, building out 5G networks, and updating the U.S. military to better prepare it for future threats. The key characteristics of this alternative approach is not its fiscal impact. Trillions of federal dollars would be spent either way. The challenge is to help position the economy for a brighter future, even at the cost of some dislocation as jobs shift. My bet? By the end of the summer, we will see that without enormous additional fiscal stimulus, whether or not it's focused on building the future, or getting lucky on the virus, either because it mutates to a less potent form or because effective drugs become available sooner than anticipated, we still face a very long ordeal ahead.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, June 10, 2020. Moments of silence. Black Lives Matter protesters marched and held a vigil of silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds Saturday along Andrews Highway. The march was in memory of George Floyd, who had a knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds before his death, May 25. Election update. There will be a joint primary runoff election and a hospital district sales tax election on July 14 in Midland County. Those wanting to vote and who have not registered must register to vote 30 days before the election. The deadline to register to vote is June 15. Early voting begins on June 29, and the deadline to submit an application for ballot by mail is July 2. Meetings. Commissioner's Court, 8:30 a.m., Auxiliary Courtroom, Midland County Courthouse, 500 North Lorraine Street, Midland ISD, 4:30 p.m., Virtual Meeting, midlandisd.net/stream. Pools open today. Washington Aquatic Center, 1601 East Indiana Avenue. Session A, noon to 3 p.m. Session B, 4 to 7 p.m. Cost per session is $3. How sick are you? Midland Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate healthcare option, whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. When it's open, Midland County Tax Assessor Collector, 2110 North A Street, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, Friday 8 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, 688-4810. Midland Central Appraisal District, 4631 Andrews Highway, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 699-4991. Department of Public Safety, Driver's License Office, 2800 Wright Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday and Wednesday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays, 686-1120. U.S. Postal Service, Downtown, 100 East Wall Street, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, Village, 2315 West Louisiana Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, Graves, 3304 West Wadley Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, Claydesta, 612 Veterans Air Park Lane, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, GMF Midland, 1000 Loop 40, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Today in History. Today's Wednesday, June 10, the 162nd day of 2020. There are 204 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On June 10, 1971, President Richard M. Nixon lifted a two-decades-old trade embargo on China. On this date, in 1967, 6 days of war in the Mideast involving Israel, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq ended as Israel and Syria accepted a United Nations-mediated ceasefire. In 1977, James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., escaped from Brushy Mountain State Prison in Tennessee with 6 others. He was recaptured June 13. In 1991, 11-year-old J.C. Dugard of South Lake Tahoe, California, was abducted by Philip and Nancy Garrido. J.C. was held by the couple for 18 years before she was found by authorities. 10 years ago, the NCAA sanctioned the University of Southern California with a 2-year bowl ban, 4 years probation, loss of scholarships, and forfeits of an entire year's games for improper benefits given to Heisman Trophy winner Reggie Bush. Today's birthdays. Football Hall of Famer Dan Fouts is 69. Country singer-songwriter Tom Schuler is 68.
This is the obituary column, Wednesday, June 10, 2020. Burt Cornelius Jr. Burt Cornelius Jr. was a man of the greatest generation, born on June 2, 1925 in Bronte, Texas, to the late Burt and Molly Cornelius. He is survived by his wife of 73 years, Oweta Cornelius, his son Gordon Cornelius, and wife Donna of Midland, daughter Debbie Glenman of Midland, son Bruce Cornelius, and wife Carolyn of Lipan. Burt is also survived by 7 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be Wednesday, June 10th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. The service will be June 11th at 1 p.m. in the chapel at Ellis Funeral Home, followed by burial at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, please give to Cal Farley Boys Ranch or your favorite charity. Donald William Gunn. On June 5, 2020, our families bid farewell to a true gentleman, Donald William Gunn, was a man of his word, a man of few words, and a man who always find the right words. Don was born November 29, 1936 in Springfield, Massachusetts, to William and Doris Gunn. Don married his high school sweetheart, Dolores Ann, in 1961. 3 sons blessed their 50-year union, Jim, Scott, and Todd, each of whom Don adored. His beloved wife, Dolores, passed away on January 2011 after a lengthy illness, with Don always by her side. In 2012, Don met his second life partner, Hetty Tetzlaff. Together, they created a life of second chances, exploring the world and sharing many happy times together. Don is survived by his loving and devoted partner, Hetty Tetzlaff, his three sons, James, Scott, and Todd, his granddaughter, Heidi, great-grandson, Colin, his Aunt Phyllis and Hetty's children, their spouses and grandchildren. His friends, family, neighbors, and the circle of eight will miss him very much. Services will be held Tuesday, June 9th at 10 a.m. at Rosewood Funeral Home in Humble, Texas, with graveside burial to follow. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the SPCA or the Salvation Army. Patsy Jean Dillard, our sister, aunt, cousin, friend, reached the sunset of her life on May 31, 2020. Born Patsy Jean Dillard, March 6, 1945, to Herbert Henry Dillard and Bessie Lauren Griffith of Midland, Texas. Patsy was preceded in death by her parents and her beloved sister Linda Sue Gallion. She is survived by her sister Shirley Cook, one nephew David Cook and wife Stephanie, one great-nephew Seth Cook and Timothy Gallion, husband of the late Linda Sue Gallion, who is considered our brother and friend, also by many loved cousins and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 West Mockingbird Lane, Odessa, Texas, 79763. A visitation, musical in nature, will be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Friday, June 12th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, 3800 North Big Spring Street, Midland. Services will be held on Saturday, June 13th, 11 a.m. at the Downtown Church of Christ, North A and Tennessee, Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood was born March 9, 1922 in Willow Glen, Muhlenberg County, Kentucky. Her parents were the late John Riddle Perry and Willie Tooley. She married Alton Alexander Galt on August 17, 1943 in Brownsville, Kentucky. He preceded her in death and she later remarried. Her last husband was Rayford Wood, who also preceded her in death. Sarah Ruth passed away at Ashton Medical Lodge in Midland, Texas on June 6, 2020. The funeral service will be at Ellis Funeral Home at 10 a.m. on Friday, June 12th. Visitation will be Thursday, June 11th from 5 to 8 p.m. Guests are required to wear masks and social distance. The service will be conducted by Chaplain Clark Rocca of Midland Odessa Hospice. Sarah Ruth Perry Galt Wood is survived by her younger sister, Lucy Helen Perry Cooper of Waynesville, North Carolina. Mrs. Wood is also survived by two daughters, Emma Ruth Stock and Ronnie Lou Davis, and husband Gary. Her middle child, Willie T. Galt Wood, preceded her in death in 2015. Mrs. Wood is also survived by her son-in-law, Thomas Wood, and Snoopy Dog, who held a special spot in her heart. Mrs. Wood has multiple grandchildren and great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, the family wishes you to consider making a memorial donation to Midland Odessa Hospice, 619 North Grant Avenue, Suite 120, Odessa, Texas, 79761. A visitation will be held Thursday, June 11th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, and the funeral service will be held Friday, June 12th at 10 a.m. at Ellis Funeral Home Chapel with graveside to follow at Fairview Cemetery. Timothy Joseph Haynes. With deepest sorrow, we announce the passing of our son, Timothy Joseph Haynes. Timothy was born in Midland on April 14, 1988, and passed away on April 16, 2020. At the time of Timothy's death, he was working as a cook and living in Cedar Park, Texas. Timothy attended Lee High School. Timothy was a gifted guitar player. Timothy had the kind of personality where he never met a stranger. He could be in a room 10 minutes and be friends with everyone. Timothy is survived by his parents, Jackie and Pat Hayes, brothers Joshua, wife Heather, Corey, wife Ariel, and nieces Sophia and Desi Ray and nephew Lincoln, several aunts and uncles and cousins and a lot of friends. He is now in heaven with paternal grandmother Betty Walls and maternal grandparents B.B. and Earlene Watson and Uncle Tom Watson. There will be memorial service at a later date. Tommy Joe Mays. Tommy Joe Mays, 82, went to be with his Savior on Sunday, June 7, 2020, surrounded by his loving family at his home in Baird, Texas. Services will be held on Thursday, June 11th at 2 p.m. in Morrison Funeral Home Chapel in Graham. Burial will follow at Murray Cemetery in Young County. Arrangements are under the direction of Morrison Funeral Home. Tommy was born on December 21, 1937, in Graham, to the late Joseph William Mays and Lassie Faye Moreland Mays. He married Carolyn K. Bond in Midland on July 25, 1959. Tommy is survived by his wife, Carolyn Mays of Baird, sons Darren Mays and wife Kimberly of Baird, and Steve Mays and wife Laura of Flint, sister Mary Glenn Tatch of Midland, three grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. Memorials may be made to Kinder Hearts Hospice, 842 North Mockingbird Lane, Abilene, Texas, 79603. Visitation will be Wednesday at Morrison Funeral Home Chapel in Graham from 6 to 8 p.m.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, June 10th. ENT to perform cochlear implant. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Ear, nose, and throat specialist Dr. Rafael Nuojo is about to perform a cochlear implant, which will be among the first in West Texas. Having done tons of them during his training in Miami, Nuojo, whose practice is West Texas ENT and sinus, said cochlear implants have been around since the 1950s when they were developed. But the roots go back more than 200 years, according to an article on the history of the implants. Quote, "The process of hearing happens when sound waves hit your pinna, the outside of the ear. This helps guide sound waves into your ear canal. Those sound waves will move this eardrum. The eardrum has ossicles, or bones, attached to them, and then the final bone, called the stapes, attaches to the wall of your vestibule. Once that sound wave hits the eardrum, these three bones help magnify the movement and create a fluid wave which is turned into electrical signal in your cochlear hear," Nuojo said, pointing to a replica of an ear. The major types of hearing loss are conductive hearing loss, sensorial neural hearing loss, and mixed hearing loss, Nuojo said. Quote, "If it's conductive, it's mechanical, meaning anything obstructing this pathway, obstructing this middle ear space, either fluid or a break in the ossicles. The sensorial neural hearing loss, just like the name says, sensory, meaning the problem is at the level of a nerve. Mixed is when you have both the conductive system or electrical system is off," Nuojo said. "With traditional hearing loss, you're amplifying the sound high enough to be able to go past the loss. After a while, if a lot of the nerve is done, no matter how much you raise the volume, the patient can't make sense of what they're hearing." Quote, "That's where a cochlear implant comes in. With a cochlear implant, you're bypassing this entire mechanism and you're putting an electrode straight into the cochlear, part of the middle ear," Nuojo said. "The surgery takes about an hour, but Nuojo said the time it takes depends on the surgeon doing the procedure. Quote, "It can take an hour to an hour and a half. I've done some in 45 minutes. It's easier in babies than in adults because it's not as big a mastoid," he said. "As you get older, you shouldn't need more surgeries," Nuojo said. "The outside of your ear doesn't get any bigger than it is at age 6. According to the MedicineNet.com website, quote, the mastoid bone is in the back part of the temporal bone of the skull behind the inner ear, end quote. The Mayo Clinic website says, quote, the middle ear includes three small bones, the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup. The middle ear is separated from your external ear by the eardrum and connected to the back of your nose and throat by a narrow passageway called the eustachian tube. The cochlea, a snail-shaped structure, is part of your inner ear, end quote. The newer implants have apps that can be used on smartphones and Bluetooth connections. Quote, you can connect directly to a TV that has that capability. It's amazing what they can do these days, Nemoja said. People who are candidates for cochlear implants are children who are born deaf but still have the structures in place. Quote, so before we do one of these, we have to scan to make sure you have these structures because you have congenital anomalies where the child is born without some of the organs in the ears, so you figure that out first, Nwojo said. A child implanted before age one can have a normal linguistic life. Quote, if they're born deaf and they go through to age four and then you implant them, they don't do as well as implanting them before one, he added. Other good candidates are people who were hearing prior to becoming deaf. Quote, they do extremely well because the brain is already trained to receive sound, and then they lose it either from an accident or just naturally aging and whatever. If you re-implant them, they do extremely well, he said. Nwojo added that insurance covers the procedure. Ronnie Cho's brother, Jimmy, is due to have the implant later this month. Both men live in Hobbs, New Mexico. Ronnie Cho said finding a doctor to do the procedure was the first hard part. Quote, then they did some real strict hearing tests that you have to take because you have to be just about flat deaf to qualify for one and Medicare to cover it. My brother is, they determined, completely deaf. He can pick up a sound or two with a hearing aid, but not much. He mostly depends on reading lips and has most of his life. Of course, he's 70 now, Ronnie Choate said. Ronnie Choate said his brother has used hearing aids off and on through the years. Quote, it helped a little bit, but this should be a game changer if it does what they say it will do, Ronnie Choate said. Ronnie started in January to find a doctor for his brother. They were scheduled for March, but then COVID-19 hit and all elective surgeries were canceled. He said he is excited about the procedure. Quote, I think it's probably to do him a bunch of good, Ronnie Choate said. He said he was told it takes about 6 weeks for the surgery to heal, and then over the next 3 to 6 months, the brain will begin to interpret the signals as sounds, and Jimmy will learn to hear again. Ronnie said his brother is severely handicapped, his short-term memory is not good, but his long-term memory is and doesn't speak well. Quote, it's not an automatic thing, Ronnie Choate said. He doesn't talk well. He's real hard to understand, but I think a lot of that's due to not being able to hear, and I'm hoping that will improve his speech over the next couple of years, end quote. Ronnie said Jimmy lives by himself, mows lawns, cooks, and cleans. Their mother died in mid-May at age 91, and Ronnie said Jimmy is in extremely good health. If he lives another 20 years, he might as well be able to hear. Quote, we're excited about it. We've got high expectations. I hope it works. I think it will. They have a pretty good track record from what I read. They have a pretty good results from it for the most part, Ronnie said. OC in top 10 for Aspen Prize. Odessa College has once again been recognized as a top 10 Aspen Prize community college in the nation. Officials announced the accomplishment Tuesday during a news conference in the lobby of the Salisbury Campus Center. The grand prize is $1 million. This is Odessa College's third time as an Aspen Prize finalist. In 2017 and 2019, Odessa was honored as a rising star for exceptional levels of improvement, a news release said. The 10 Aspen Prize finalists were selected from the nation's 1,000 community colleges in a process that included qualitative and quantitative data analysis and engaged more than 30 experts in the field. These finalists all effectively identify, develop, and scale strategies to propel all students to not just complete college, but also succeed after graduation, the release said. Quote, "For students and for our community, as well as the workforce, this is a really important designation," Vice President of Student Development and Enrollment Management Kim McKay said. Continuing the quote, "It means that we continue to put students first. Our outcomes with regard to student completion and student excellence are phenomenal. We're educating students and preparing graduates for a talent pipeline that is ready-made for the oil and gas industry and really ready-made for any industry in the nation," end quote. Quote, "Our students are taught by some of the most well-prepared and most experienced faculty in the nation. They are completing courses and succeeding in those courses at rates that we've never seen before. So we're so pleased to once again be recognized as one of 10 preeminent colleges in the nation. There are 1,100 community colleges in the nation, and so to be recognized for the third time in the top 10 is something that we're extremely proud of. We'll continue to work hard to focus on students and ensure that they are on a pathway to degree completion," end quote. McKay said the Aspen Prize is a competition among colleges from around the nation. You have to be invited to apply. Quote, "There are about 100 institutions, I think, that get invited to apply," she said. "They narrow that down to about 50 institutions. They're invited to a phone conference or a phone call with the individuals from the Aspen Prize Committee, and then they narrow it down to 10. Texas is strongly represented in that 10. I believe we have 4 Texas colleges. There are 2 Florida colleges, and then colleges from coast to coast. We feel like Texas is well represented. It's our third time to be nominated for this particular prize, and we're hoping that third time is the charm," McKay said. The last 2 times OC had a site visit from the Aspen Prize team that learned more about what OC is doing to focus on student success and make a difference in higher education. Quote, "This year, we anticipate those visits will occur in the fall. We also know that they will occur online this time," McKay added. The prize will be awarded, she anticipates, sometime in spring 2021. Quote, "The first year, in 2017, it was awarded in March. The second time we went through this process, it was awarded in April. So I anticipate spring 2021 is when we will get the great announcement that we've been named the number 1 community college in the nation. Fingers crossed," McKay said. OC President Gregory Williams and Vice President for Institutional Effectiveness Don Wood reviewed the college's accomplishments even in the midst of COVID-19. Williams said they couldn't have done it without their students, employees, and a supportive community. "Awarded every 2 years since 2011, the Aspen Prize recognizes institutions that achieve strong student outcomes across 4 key areas: teaching and learning, degree completion and successful transfer to 4-year institutions, success in the workforce, equitable outcomes for diverse student groups.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.